I'm for openers, Miss Howard answered, though I think Mrs. Wright is correct when she says that Libby wouldn't be satisfied with just those qualities. No, it was something else, too, a kind of respectability in a way. No, more than that. Redemption, maybe.
Redemption, Lucius said.
An inside track to God, I threw in.
Yes, that's closer to it, Stevie,
Miss Howard answered, urging the little black Morgan along toward Mr. Picton's house.
I'm not exactly clear. I want to get the doctor's opinion.
We'd reached the section of our route where the Charlton Road became Charlton Street. Standing up to try to peer ahead through the dimming light of the evening, I soon caught sight of the four turrets of Mr. Picton's house, and I also saw the surrey standing horseless by the porch.
"Well, it looks like you'll get your chance," I said to Miss Howard. "They're back from the Westons."
After we'd pulled up to the house, we put the section of boarding and the driver's seat from the Hatches wagon up on the porch, and went inside, entering the living room to find Cyrus at Mr. Picton's piano and our host standing in the far corner where the doctor was transferring notes onto a large chalkboard what had appeared. The thing was well on its way to becoming a duplicate of the one at number 808 Broadway, and Mr. Picton was clearly fascinated by the process.
"Now this," Miss Howard said with a smile, making them all aware of our entrance, "is a homey little scene, isn't it?"
Cyrus stopped playing, and the doctor and Mr. Picton came over to us quickly.
"At last," the doctor said. "What news from the Hatch House? Our new board awaits."
The next hour or so was one of those jumbled times, as everybody tried to explain to everybody else what progress had been made during our first day in town. Things between the doctor and Clara Hatch had continued to go very well after I'd left the Westons farm, and though the girl still hadn't given out with any actual words, the doctor was sure that he could eventually coax her to do so. It wouldn't be easy. Clara was in a state of what the doctor called protracted, hysterical disassociation, meaning that what she'd seen was too terrible to make any sense of, either to herself or to anybody else. But Mr. Picton made it clear that we had to get her to talk. He didn't have a ghost of a chance of getting his boss, District Attorney Oakley Pearson, to agree to summon a grand jury to consider an indictment against Libby Hatch unless Clara was prepared to say flat out that her mother had shot her. We could assemble all the physical evidence in the world, but none of it would count for much in a case that had aroused so much emotion and would surely fire up a new kind of outrage when we announced our theory of the crime, if the girl didn't talk. Though he went on for quite a while explaining all this to us, Mr. Picton's basic point was simple. If you were going to accuse a woman of murdering her own kids, you'd better be damned sure you had not only motive, opportunity, and means, but a witness, too. Motive, opportunity, and means would still, though, play their parts, and these were things that we could pursue while the doctor went about the process of trying to get Clara Hatch to communicate. The subject that seemed the most open to investigation that evening was means, being as Lucius had, we hoped, brought the instrument of attack up out of the old well. Asking Mrs. Hastings for a piece of oilcloth, what he proceeded to drape over the piano, Lucius carefully positioned his damp brown parcel on the thing, then slowly began to unfold and pull away the paper bag with a couple of his steel medical probes.
"I asked Mrs. Wright if she'd noticed anything unusual about the gun before she dropped it down the well," Miss Howard said as we all crowded around Lucius, "anything that might indicate that it had been moved or fired, but she said she'd been far too upset to take any notice of those kind of details."
"Understandable," Marcus said, watching his brother straighten out the bag, its hidden contents still bulging outward.
"Did she say how old the thing was?"
"Hatch told Mrs. Wright he'd always kept it under his pillow," Miss Howard said. "He didn't fight in the Civil War himself. He paid a substitute, so that eliminates the possibility of it being a weapon he picked up in the army."
"Yes," Marcus answered, "it's probably one of the more common store-bought brands, and given his age, along with the likelihood that he hadn't fired guns very often, he probably wanted something easy to use."
"Right," Miss Howard continued. "Something like a Colt Peacemaker. It looks like one from the silhouette. An early edition, too. The first single-action Army models came out when? In 71? The timing would be about right."
"But is it a weapon that would be easy for a woman to use?" the doctor asked. It was the kind of question that Marcus or Lucius would ordinarily have answered, but Miss Howard enjoyed the limelight, and the two brothers knew enough to stay out of her way.
"I don't see why not," she said with a shrug. "A 45 caliber pistol might not seem like a woman's weapon on the surface, but the single-action army used metal cartridges and had very smooth action. A fairly simple, serviceable piece, really. Add the fact that even the longer-barreled models didn't weigh much more than 3 pounds, and she would have been fine, even if she didn't have much experience with guns."
I saw Mr. Picton give Miss Howard a surprised look, and then turn to Mr. Moore. "Do not," Mr. Moore said, "push your luck with this girl, Rupert."
Lucius suddenly looked troubled. "I don't think I can get the bag off in one piece."
"Any reason why you need to?" Mr. Moore said. "If we can prove that the wrapping was manufactured locally," Marcus explained for his brother, "then it argues against the possibility that this was some other gun dumped more recently by someone else."
"Well, you don't need to keep it in one piece to do that," Mr. Picton said. "Look at the bottom of the thing, detective. You should find the words, 'West Bags, Boston Spa, New York,' in small black print."
Lucius focused his attention on the part of the bag what was draped around the mouth of the gun barrel. Then he brightened up.
"You're right, Mr. Picton. It's there. Let me just cut it loose."
He pulled a surgical scalpel from his pocket and made 4 neat little slits in the bottom of the bag, then pulled away a rectangular piece of the brown paper and laid it out carefully on the sheet.
"There we go. And now we can—"
With slightly faster strokes, Lucius began to peel away strips of the remaining brown paper, revealing a plain, single-action revolver of the type seen in your standard Western magazine illustrations. Its dark brown grips were dusted with light green mold, and its blue steel chamber and barrel were red with rust. None of the rest of us knew quite what to think until Lucius picked up the gun by slipping one of his probes through the trigger guard, examined it with his brother, and then smiled.
"Thank you, Mr. West," he sighed.
"You mean it's in good shape?" Mr. Moore said.
"Let's just say this," Lucius answered. "Boston Spa is, in fact, the home of the world's finest paper bags."
Marcus nodded confidently as he took his turn examining the pistol.
Yes, he said, trying to control his enthusiasm. "With a little work we should be able to actually fire it again."
"And that means—" Mr. Moore asked.
"That means," Miss Howard answered, herself smiling, "a ballistics test."
Mr. Moore's face went blank.
"A what?"
"Provided," Lucius said, putting down the gun and holding up a finger, "that we can find a bullet in those pieces of the wagon for comparison."
"Whoa, slow down here," Mr. Moore said.
"What about it, Mr. Picton?" Marcus asked. "How are your judges on the subject of ballistics analysis?"
Mr. Picton shrugged. "They're aware of the field, of course, but to my knowledge we haven't yet had a case where it's been used to convict. On the other hand, I can't think of one where it's been specifically excluded either, and our judges don't tend to be absolutely primitive about such matters. They don't mind setting a precedent every now and then. If we come up with something convincing, especially if it's in conjunction with other evidence, I think I can run it up the pole and get a salute."
"Run what up the pole?" Mr. Moore said. "What the hell are you people talking about?" I was in a pretty confused state myself, and I could see that the doctor and Cyrus weren't doing much better. But we prefer to let Mr. Moore keep asking the dumb questions, being as—and I say this with all due respect to the man's more admirable qualities—it came so natural to him. "Assuming we can make it work," Lucius said to Mr. Picton, still ignoring Mr. Moore, "we'll need to set up a firing range of some kind."
"Well," Mr. Picton answered happily, indicating the back of the house, "my yard is yours, detective. There's nothing but a large cornfield beyond it, if you'll tell me what you need."
"Not much," Lucius answered. "Just a few bales of cotton."
"Easily done," Mr. Picton answered. "Mrs. Hastings, we—"
He turned to find his housekeeper already standing at the doorway, watching us with a blank, dumbfounded look.
"Ah, Mrs. Hastings, call Mr. Burke, if you would, and tell him—"
"Yes, sir,"
Mrs. Hastings answered, turning away and throwing up her arms.
"A few bales of cotton, sir, so's you can shoot up the backyard."
"This should be ideal," Miss Howard said, still staring at the gun.
"Oh, yes," Mr. Moore chimed in, his voice taking that turn toward whining it generally did at such moments. "Ideal. Don't bother to explain it to the rest of us, though, whatever you do."
Mr. Picton laughed at that, then turned to his old friend. "I'm sorry, John. We're being a bit rude, aren't we? How about this, to make amends? We've taken care of just about everything we can for today. In fact, I'd say it's been a particularly successful afternoon. What about hopping on the trolley and heading up to Canfield's? We can talk more about it over dinner, then some roulette, maybe a few hands of cards."
"Silence," Mr. Moore commanded, holding up a hand and suddenly looking eager and excited.
"Everyone upstairs and into your dinner clothes before there's any more discussion or Rupert changes his mind. Go, all of you, go."
"And if we don't want to go?"
Miss Howard protested, as Mr. Moore pushed her toward the stairs.
"I'm not interested in—"
"Then you can simply eat and come right home," Mr. Moore said, cutting her off. "Leave the rest of us to lose our wanton souls."
I jumped for the stairs quickly, but then, remembering something, I turned to Mr. Moore.
"You'll lay my bets for me? They don't let kids play in that place, I hear."
"Have no fear, Stevie," Mr. Moore answered. "I'll follow your instructions to the letter, but all the same, you're going to have to put on the monkey suit just to get into the dining room."
I nodded back at him and smiled.
"That's why I brought it. Only thing that could get me to wear the thing's an honest game."
Charging on up the stairs, I shot into my room, closed the door, and tore open the big mahogany armoire where I'd stuck a set of evening clothes what the doctor had bought for me a year or so back. I think he'd been hoping in those days that I might develop some kind of a taste for opera and get to the point where I'd actually enjoy tagging along with him and Cyrus to the Metropolitan. But so far, I'd been in a doctor's box at said house and had said suit of evening clothes on exactly once, and then only because it had been important to the Beecham investigation. But this time around I was happy to cram myself into the stiff, starched white shirt and the black jacket and pants, if it meant that I could get some bets down on a reliable roulette wheel which I'd always heard could be found at Richard Canfield's famous gaming house and restaurant in Saratoga, known throughout most of the country as just the casino. Still, desire to get the clothes on wasn't any substitute for experience at doing it. I huffed and cursed as I stuffed and belted and pulled my way into the things, finally leaving the tie for somebody else to take care of. By the time I got downstairs, all the others were ready to go, and Mr. Moore grumbled impatiently as Miss Howard very decently did up the band of white silk what was dangling around my neck. Finally, we left the house and strolled down in the warm darkness to Ballston Spa's electric trolley station, where we boarded a small open car in high spirits, never suspecting for a moment that our host intended this little trip as something more than just recreation.
Chapter 32. The Ballston-Saratoga trolley system was only a year old, and looked it. The car that we boarded had polished railings and clean appointments, and it was set on top of a shining set of narrow tracks. The thing moved at a good clip through the 4 or 5 miles of countryside what separated Ballston Spa from Saratoga's Main Street, Broadway, and the breeze that hit us in our seats at the front of the car was refreshing and even exciting, given where we were going. It was the kind of air what heightens anticipation, you might say. And though the trip lasted only 15 minutes or so, it seemed to my young soul to go on forever. When the car finally did slip into America's greatest recreational center, it did so by way of the southern end of Broadway. From that spot we got an excellent view down into the heart of the town. And I've got to say, it was a wonder to behold. Lined by spreading beautiful elm trees, Saratoga's Broadway, taken as just a street, would have been a credit to any town anywhere. But behind the trees, the well-tended sidewalks, and the street lamps stood the blazing lights of countless shops and the city's massive hotels, all of which promised excitement of every stripe and gave the lie to the town's outdated label of resort. There was no sign that retreat and relaxation were prized goods or even possibilities in Saratoga. The old days, when political men, scholars, and artists from all over the world had met to take the waters together and talk of lofty things, were definitely gone by 1897, and the place was a full-blown pleasure market. Canfield's Casino
was a square, mansion-like building located down in a green, shady park where the Congress Spring, one of the town's many old mineral water fountains, had formerly been the main attraction. The casino had actually been built by another famous gambler, John Morrissey, a burly Irish prize fighter and Tammany tough who'd made use of his winnings to set himself up in the gaming room and horse track businesses. Morrissey had also built Saratoga's first track. During the construction in 1870-1871 of what had then been known as the Clubhouse, Morrissey had pumped every Italianate luxury he could think of into the place, and it had done a booming business from the start. It hadn't been enough, though, to net Morrissey the prize he wanted most, acceptance by the society types who came to fritter their dollars away by the thousands in his establishment. He died in 1878, and ownership of the joint had passed around to various second-rate operators for a time, until it was bought and refurbished in 1894 by its current owner, Richard Canfield. Canfield, like Morrissey, had made a personal fortune in the gambling trade, though he didn't have the thug's past, what had kept Morrissey from ever being treated like a true gentleman. Having run gaming houses in Providence, Rhode Island, and then in New York, Canfield had spent his spare time, and a short prison term, turning himself into a kind of self-taught scholar and art critic. When he took over Morrissey's clubhouse, he put all his learning to work, filling the joint with top-of-the-line furniture and art, building a big new gourmet dining room, and hiring one of the most famous French chefs in the world to cook for his patrons. And by refusing to allow women and kids to play at his tables, he'd even outsmarted the reformers who, for a short time during his early days of operation, had tried to shake things up in Saratoga and had actually succeeded in getting a lot of other smaller houses closed down. At the same time, though, Canfield had built said women and children a nice big lounge where they could amuse themselves with ices and entertainments and tell their husbands and fathers what bets to put down for them. The park around the casino was a suitable setting for all this luxurious recreation, with its fountains, pools, statues, and handsome trees lining the walkway to the ivy-covered walls of the three-story casino. We entered the building that night through the front door, the detective sergeants noting with relief that Mr. Canfield was one of the few gaming house and hotel operators in Saratoga who didn't hang a "Jewish patronage not solicited" sign outside his establishment. Once in, we found ourselves in a large, crowded, and thickly carpeted lobby what was just outside the public gaming room. Inside this room, the stakes were low. White chips went for $1, red for $5, blue for $10, yellow for $100, and brown for $1,000, compared to what went on in the private rooms upstairs, where everything was multiplied by 100. Antsy as I was to start playing, I have to confess that I was even more anxious that night to meet the man who was famous everywhere as the Prince of Gamblers. I didn't have long to wait. As soon as we walked in, I caught sight of a fleshy but knowledgeable-looking soul, clean-shaven, with dark eyes that took in everything what was going on around him. The face was so fascinating that it eventually snagged the interest of no less a painter than Mr. J. A. M. Whistler, who reproduced it on canvas. When said face observed Mr. Picton's entrance, it and the rest of the man hurried on over, putting a hand out in happy greeting. "Well, Mr. Picton," Mr. Canfield said, "feeling up to a night at the tables, are you, or is it just Columban's cooking that brings you up?" "Canfield," Mr. Picton said, with heartfelt good cheer, "no, I have some house guests for a time, and I told them they couldn't leave the county without seeing our greatest contribution to modern American culture." Mr. Picton made a quick round of introductions, and Mr. Canfield greeted us all in the smooth way what marks the successful gambling magnate. But there was something more in it, too. It seemed like the simple fact that we were Mr. Picton's guests meant that we'd get some kind of special treatment. "Mr. Picton was a big help at a particularly dicey time," Mr. Canfield explained, as if he could hear the thought what was in my head. "During the town's nasty little reform fit, he argued to the county that Saratoga could shut down all the smaller houses it wanted to, but that it had to let establishments of quality, like the casino, stay open, unless it wanted to go back to depending on mineral water for its livelihood." "I don't know that I was quite so instrumental, Canfield," Mr. Picton said. "Even the staunchest of the reformers eventually saw that they were cutting their own throats. How's the crowd tonight?" "Oh, they're all here," Mr. Canfield answered, starting to walk us toward the dining room. "Brady, Miss Russell, Jesse Lewison, and Gates is upstairs, still determined to set a record."
This lineup had me speechless. The names of Diamond Jim Brady, the railroad supply magnate with a stomach 6 times normal size and an appetite for food that was almost as big as his lust for precious stones, and Miss Lillian Russell, the famous entertainer, and Brady's constant companion were, of course, well known to the world at large back then, as they still are. But in gambling circles, the names of Jesse Lewison, the sporting banker, and Mr. John Gates, who'd soon earned the nickname Bet a Million for losing and then winning back almost that sum all in one day at Saratoga, were just as legendary and cause for even greater excitement.
"Brady's in the dining room, of course," Mr. Canfield went on. "Been through half of Cullenbaum's stock already, and he's calling for more. I'll get your table away from him. Even with the diamonds, he doesn't do much for other people's appetites at moments like this."
Signaling to a waiter at the entrance to the dining room, Mr. Canfield shook Mr. Picton's hand again.
"Albert'll take care of you all. I'll see you in the gaming room. I assume you won't want any action upstairs."
Mr. Picton shook his head with a smile.
"On my salary? Not a prayer, Canfield. We can injure ourselves quite sufficiently in the public room, thanks."
Mr. Canfield paid his respects to the rest of us and then started to disappear back into the crowd. But then, seeming to remember something, he stopped.
"Oh, by the way, Picton, word's going around that you're going to reopen that case, the one where the kids got shot."
The rest of us couldn't do much to hide our surprise, but Mr. Picton just smiled and shook his head.
"All right, Canfield," he said, "I'll try to keep you posted."
"You know how it is," Mr. Canfield answered, with a respectful shrug. "People in this town'll bet on anything, and do. There's bound to be a line on the manhunt and the trial. I'd just like to be able to set some reasonable odds."
2-1 on the manhunt for now," Mr. Picton answered. "As for the trial, I'll let you know."
Mr. Canfield gave that what you might call an appreciative look.
2-1? Confident.
Confident, Mr. Picton said. "Though who we actually arrest may surprise you."
Mr. Canfield nodded, turned, and with another signal of departure went back to his business of making suckers happy.
"And that, my friends," Mr. Picton said, "is what I mean about word traveling fast in these towns."
"Do you mean to say they're going to bet on this case?"
the doctor asked, taking in the wealthy crowd and starting to look a little revolted.
"Unquestionably. But you can get that gleam out of your eye, Moore," Mr. Picton said, glancing at his friend. "Canfield didn't get where he is by letting people with inside information fleece him."
Mr. Picton began to walk toward the far end of the lobby.
"Well, then, let's eat, shall we?"
Our table in the dining room might have been far away from Diamond Jim Brady's and Miss Lillian Russell's, like Mr. Canfield said, but we still had to pass by that famous pair to get to our seats. And such was not exactly a heartening experience. Not that we had any actual contact with the couple or their party, but I quickly found out, just by watching their antics, that what makes an amusing legend can sometimes amount to a pretty depressing reality. I knew all about Diamond Jim's famous sets of jewelry pieces, the sum of what totaled some 20,000 diamonds. And of course, I knew about his appetite. But none of those stories prepared me for the sight of a hog-faced man whose famous girth was stuffed inside clothes what vanity dictated be 2 sizes too small, going about his usual mealtime trick, starting with his diamond-studded belly about 1 foot from the table and refusing to stop eating until it touched the edge of the thing. At the particular moment we walked by, he was doing his worst to a whole family of lobsters and had a bib tied around his pricey white suit and his precious diamonds. He was loud, too. Loud, foul-mouthed, and very easy with what he said to his ladies, knowing full well that, given his millions and their own lack of any talent other than being pretty, they'd not only have to put up with it, but smile and laugh, too. Next to Diamond Jim was Miss Lillian Russell, whose face, of course, I'd seen on billboards in New York, though it occurred to me when I saw her in the flesh for the first time that they'd been damned flattering billboards. She, too, was lapping up Brady's loud vulgarity like a cat going at a dish of milk. Now, I don't mean to sound prudish. God knows my mouth wasn't then and still isn't what it ought to be.
but there's a difference between certain ripe choices in vocabulary and downright obnoxious behavior, and Brady was what you might call that difference made flesh. We all knew the rumor that Miss Russell didn't actually grant her sexual favors to Brady. It didn't seem possible that anybody could actually perform the physical act with that tub of excess, but was rolling in the hay with Brady's pal, Jesse Lewison. That night, though, I figured that Mr. Lewison wasn't getting such a hot deal. Miss Russell might have been a famous performer, but she also had a figure what showed she'd done some damage at many a dinner table herself. Whatever poor team of maidservants had to stuff her into the kind of tight-waisted gown she was wearing that evening earned their pay as sure as any coal miner, that much was certain. The rest of the activity in that dining room, which was a beautiful, long hall with small stained-glass windows set into the ceiling and a polished oak floor, tended along the lines set at the Brady table. All the other patrons in the place were stuffing themselves, drinking like fish, talking way too loud, and flirting in ways that would have earned the average streetwalker in New York a night in a local precinct. These were respectable people, too, in their ordinary lives, people who, when they went back down the Hudson, were responsible for big business and government decisions, and for the lives of millions of ordinary people into the bargain. It was a good thing we'd come for the gambling, I began to think. If we'd had to do any socializing, I don't think I could have stood it. I wasn't alone, either. By the end of our meal, the general mood at our table had grown pretty disgusted. And as we walked out, I discovered that such was exactly why the devious Mr. Picton had brought us to this spot. "Get a good last look, all of you," he said, "because if we succeed in bringing Libby Hatch to trial, it won't be just the outrage of the humble citizens in towns like Ballston Spa that we'll have to deal with. No, no. All the mighty weight of this sparkling society will come crashing down on our heads, too. For it's the essence of hypocrisy, isn't it, Doctor, that it requires masks to hide behind? And the masks of the idyllic home and the sanctity of motherhood are the first and most untouchable of all. Yes, if I'm right, you can expect to see some of these same faces sitting in the galleries of the Ballston Courthouse in the weeks to come." Which wasn't exactly the most charitable thought to offer at a moment when some of us were trying to fix our sights on recreation. Miss Howard, for her part, had seen all she could stand in the dining room and elected to head back to Mr. Picton's house on the trolley right away. The doctor, Cyrus, and the detective sergeants, none of them possessing much real sporting blood, all agreed to accompany her, clearing the field for the true enthusiasts. Mr. Moore and Mr. Picton had a couple of quick drinks, while I gave them a brief summary of my roulette strategy. And by the time they headed into the public room, they were looking and sounding like they'd managed to drown their repulsion with the crowd. As for me, barred from actually watching the games, I was left to pick between heading into the ladies' and children's lounge and going outside for a smoke. Not what you'd call a tough choice. Wandering in amongst the long branches of a weeping willow that hung over one of the little pools of water in the park outside the casino, I pulled at my starched collar and tie with an annoyed groan, wishing I could just take the things off. Then I lit a stick and began to think, not about what my earnings might amount to if all went well inside, but about what Mr. Picton had said in the dining room. It wasn't what you'd call comforting to think that by prosecuting Libby Hatch, we'd be riling and maybe even threatening all those rich, powerful hypocrites and philanderers. And at first I thought it was just the unpleasant notion of what lay ahead that was starting to give me a distinctly nervous sensation. But soon I realized that the ripples in my stomach had a more immediate cause, something to do with the area right around me at that moment. I couldn't say just what the uneasiness was at first, but after a couple of minutes, I put my finger on it. I was being watched. Spinning around, I stepped deeper into the branches of the willow and searched the darkness all around me. But there wasn't a soul to be seen anywhere in that part of the park. All the same, I grew more convinced moment by moment that somebody somewhere was observing every move I was making. Pulling at my tie and collar again as I broke into a cold sweat, I started to shift from foot to foot, breathing very fast. Finally, I called out to what seemed like nothing but empty darkness. "Who's there? What do you want?" Realizing that I was being a bit unreasonable, but unable to prevent myself, I shoved one hand into my pants pocket. "I've got a gun," I called out, "and I'll use it, I'm telling you." Suddenly, a dark blur passed in front of me. Dropping down, it seemed, from the sky, came a fast-moving shadow, one what hit the ground softly, but nonetheless caused me to shriek and jump back. Only by grabbing the trunk of the willow did I keep from falling into the pool, and though I heard fast footsteps moving away from me, by the time I looked up, the person who'd made them was gone. As I caught my breath, I realized that I was now definitely alone. I felt that as certainly as I'd sensed the stranger's presence. Whoever'd been hiding in the tree, probably some kid, I stupidly figured, must have been terrified by my mention of a gun and had lit out, more scared of me than I'd been of him. Realizing that I'd dropped my cigarette, I lit up another and then started back for the casino, laughing at my own foolishness, and never realizing what a close brush I'd had with real danger. I'd learned, though, for in a matter of hours, I'd confront that danger again. And see its face.
Chapter 33. Mr. Moore, Mr. Picton, and I didn't do half bad at the tables that night, and as a result we woke up Saturday morning with what you might call a rosy outlook on the tasks what lay ahead of us. The doctor and Cyrus had already gotten themselves together and headed back out to the Westons' farm in a small hired gig. And Marcus and Miss Howard were in the backyard of Mr. Picton's place, wrangling with three big bales of raw cotton what had been delivered earlier. Lucius, meanwhile, had set up shop on the back porch and was carefully examining every part of Daniel Hatch's colt and dusting the thing for fingerprints before he went about the business of dismantling and refurbishing it. With everyone so usefully employed, it seemed safe for Mr. Picton to head up to his office at the courthouse and continue doing his research into cases what bore some resemblance to ours, what the legal types called precedents, while Mr. Moore and I headed into the dining room to have some of Mrs. Hastings' excellent breakfast. After we'd eaten, it was our turn to be pressed into labor. Lucius gave us a pair of magnifying lenses, a medical probe, and a couple of very sharp pocket knives, and told us to get to work on the section of planking and the driver's seat from the Hatch's wagon, which the detective sergeants had dragged around to the back of the house. We were supposed to go over every inch of these two items, and when we found something that looked like it might be a bullet hole, use the medical probe to see if there was in fact a metal object lodged inside. If there was, we were most definitely not supposed to try to pry it out. Instead, we'd use the knives we'd been given to cut away all the wood around the thing in order to keep it intact. Mr. Moore and I listened to these instructions with a noticeable lack of enthusiasm, since it was clear that if we followed this procedure, it would take quite a while to free a bullet from the wood, even if we got lucky and stumbled onto one quickly. But we tried to keep the grumbling to a minimum, and before long we were wrapped up in the job. It took about an hour to come across the first likely candidate for a bullet hole. I found a small opening in one corner of the section of board and was very excited to discover that when I stuck the medical probe into it, I made contact with something what was most definitely metal. I called the detective sergeants over to get their opinions, and they agreed that what I'd found might indeed be a bullet. The important thing now was to make sure that while I was cutting the wood around the object away, I didn't touch the thing with the blade of my knife, a consideration that I, in the heat of my enthusiasm, confessed to not really understanding. If the bullet was recognizable as such, what did it matter if it had a couple of knife marks on it? That, of course, was not the sort of question you generally wanted to ask Marcus or Lucius, unless you were in the mood for a very long lecture on some budding branch of forensic science. In this particular case, Mr. Moore and I were treated to 45 uninterrupted minutes on the new field of ballistics, a clinic made all the more complete by Miss Howard's participation. Put simply, ballistics seemed to amount to the firearm's equivalent of fingerprinting. Earlier in the century, an Englishman had discovered that bullets, when they passed through the barrel of a gun, were marked by whatever distinctive defects, nicks in the metal and the like, characterized said barrel. By 1897, when almost all pistols and long arms had rifled barrels, it had been found that bullets were also marked by the rifling itself,
which was made up of what were called grooves and lands. The grooves were the spiral tracks that were carved on the inside of the barrel, rotating toward either the right or the left, to make the bullet spin as it came out of the muzzle and thereby fly much straighter through the air. The lands were the spaces between these grooves. Bullets propelled through said grooves and lands were marked by lines that exactly reflected the specific rifling of the particular barrel. This system of identification had already claimed some success, though not in the United States. Some years earlier, a French colleague of the detective sergeant's, one Monsieur Lacassagne, had matched the number, spacing, and twist of grooves on a bullet taken from a dead man to the barrel of a gun owned by a suspect. The man was afterward convicted, mostly on the strength of the ballistic evidence. Now, this judgment had, the detective sergeants admitted, been a little premature, seeing as the lands and grooves of guns had never been catalogued even by manufacturer or model, much less by the individual characteristics of specific pieces. So it was possible that somebody else in France had owned a weapon with the same arrangement of lands and grooves as the gun what belonged to the fellow who'd been convicted. But the fact remained that there were now three ways to try to determine if a given bullet had come from a particular firearm. First, obviously, there was the caliber size. Then there were particular marks left by defects in the barrel. Not that every gun necessarily had such defects, but many did. And finally, there were the number and twists of the lands and grooves. Convincing as all this might have seemed, though, even a match between a bullet and a gun on all three counts couldn't yet be considered the last word on identification, being as, again, there was no central authority that required gun manufacturers to register the individual specifications of each of their models. The possibility still existed that a given bullet, what matched a given gun according to caliber, defects, and grooves and lands, had actually been fired by some unknown matching weapon. Oh, sure, ballistic experts like the detective sergeants could protest that the chances of any two guns having exactly the same specifications were somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000,000 to 1. But even 1,000,000 to 1 left room for doubt. And so, while ballistic evidence had become what you might call mighty handy to modern-thinking investigators, it still wasn't accepted as legally conclusive. By the time the Isaacsons and Miss Howard had finished explaining this bit of business to Mr. Moore and me, I'd pretty well finished the job of getting my bit of metal free of the board, but my spirits, which had started to race at the prospect of actually being able to put a bullet to the ballistics test, sank considerably when I realized that I'd spent the better part of an hour carefully preserving an old nailhead. Such discouragement, though, was common to detective work, and I knew that much. So I picked up my magnifying lens and continued going over the surface of the wood, looking for another likely hole. Lucius, Marcus, and Miss Howard, meanwhile, continued their lecture, explaining what the younger Isaacson brother was up to with Daniel Hatch's Colt. For ballistics didn't begin and end, it seemed, with the matching of bullets to barrels. Lucius also had to carefully try to determine, based on the amount of rust and powder buildup on the peacemaker, how recently it had been fired, and how many times. The second question seemed easy enough to answer. There were three cartridges still in the six-shooter, giving the impression that three shots had been fired. This came as no big surprise. Three was the number of bullets we'd expected to be involved in a shooting of Libby Hatch's children. But as usual, when you're dealing with forensic science, things weren't as simple as they appeared. It was general practice, Miss Howard explained, for people who kept pistols in their homes to leave one chamber empty at the top position, so that if something or someone accidentally happened to catch the hammer without cocking it, the firing pin wouldn't slam back down on anything but air. And as Lucius's examination went on, the three of them became ever more convinced that Daniel Hatch had followed this procedure. Three chambers of his gun were, like I say, still loaded. But of the remaining three, only two had the kind of powder deposits that would indicate they'd been fired since the gun's last cleaning. On top of that, the third empty chamber had a larger buildup of rust than the other two, indicating it had been vacant longer. And as for the unlikely chance that somebody had found the gun, shot it, reloaded it, and dumped it back down the well, Marcus and Lucius felt they could rule that out by the measurement they took of the amount of rust in the barrel. The gun hadn't been fired in years. This was all very disturbing, for our theory that Libby Hatch had herself shot her three children to work out, we appeared to need three shots to have been fired, but only two had been discharged from the Colt. This gap perplexed Marcus and Lucius mightily, and as they continued to dust the gun for fingerprints, their faces grew as knotted as the old trees out in the yard. They did find several prints that matched Libby's on both the gun's grips and its trigger, and there was a partial print on the hammer, what they felt comfortable labeling as hers, too. But there was no sign that she'd ever touched the cylinder, which appeared to rule out the possibility that she'd reloaded and refired the thing at any point. We knew that one bullet had traveled clear through Clara Hatch's neck and hopefully lodged in some part of the wagon, probably the underside of the driver's bench. But if only one other shot had been fired, how could we account for two dead boys? Their mood getting nothing but more glum, Marcus and Lucius carefully recorded all their opening findings on the condition of the gun, and then began to disassemble the thing to get it ready for the test firing. It was Miss Howard who brought Hope back into the picture by coming up with a possible solution to the riddle of two bullets and three victims. Going for the stack of Mr. Picton's files on the shooting, which were lying inside on the piano, she pulled out Dr. Lawrence's post-mortem report on the two Hatch boys, reminding us that nowhere in the thing was there any reference to exit wounds on either Thomas's or Matthew's body. And while Lawrence did say that there were powder burns on the children, he didn't specifically state which children. Mr. Picton had assumed he'd meant all three, being as they'd all suffered gunshot wounds. But that might not have been the case. As for Libby Hatch's statements about what positions the kids had been in when they were shot, we couldn't accept those any more than we could believe anything else the woman had said. So we were free, inside of certain limits, to imagine an entirely different sequence of events from the one that Mr. Picton had dreamed up on the basis of the reports. Suppose, Miss Howard said, that little Thomas had, in fact, been sitting in Clara's lap when the rig stopped. The girl had been shot in the chest, and there was no way that anybody could have shot her in that region without first moving Thomas out of the way. So, Miss Howard said, we had to figure that Libby had taken Thomas and stuck him somewhere else, probably in Matthew's lap. Libby had then shot Clara, an act what almost certainly would have made Thomas very upset, causing Libby to shoot him quickly. Now, the Colt 45 Peacemaker was a powerful gun. The bullet what had struck Clara had traveled clear through her chest and neck, so the bullet what had hit little Thomas would definitely have gone straight through him and into whatever was behind him, or whoever was behind him, if we now accepted the idea that he'd actually been sitting in front of Matthew. This thought got Marcus's and Lucius's eyes twinkling again. Was Miss Howard suggesting, they asked, that the two boys had been killed by one bullet? To be sure, she answered, nothing else made any sense, given the state of the Colt. But before anybody went getting too happy, Miss Howard continued, we had to remember one thing. The single bullet might not have been traveling with enough power to make it through both bodies and into the front of the wagon's wooden bed. If that was the case, we were in trouble. For among the many things Dr. Lawrence's report didn't mention was his having taken any bullets out of the dead boys. In other words, if the missing bullet wasn't in the hunk of wood in front of us, then it had been buried with Matthew Hatch in Ballston's town cemetery, which was, it turned out, just around the corner from Mr. Picton's house. This realization wiped the smiles right back off the detective sergeant's faces, and also lit a new fire under me and Mr. Moore, joined now by Miss Howard, to tear the piece of planking and the driver's seat into toothpicks in an effort to find the second deadly missile. Because without it, we had no way of even suggesting that Daniel Hatch's Colt had been involved in the shootings. As we madly pursued our work, Marcus and Lucius went back to working on the gun. Mr. Picton eventually returned to his house for lunch, and over that meal we told him about our morning's work, which he found intriguing but also very unsettling. Once he'd set back out for his office, we went to work again with even more determination. But the early hours of the afternoon went by without anyone making any discoveries.
The approach of evening brought the return of Dr. Kreitzler and Cyrus, who took up positions next to us and joined in the search. Still, though, there were no hopeful sightings. We were beginning to run out of places to look, and it was Mr. Moore who first realized the dreadful implications of that fact. Along toward cocktail time, his brow had become positively creased by discouragement. But when Mr. Picton came home and suggested that everyone quit working and have a drink before dinner, Mr. Moore forced himself to put on a cheery face and urged the detective sergeants, whose eyes had gone bloodshot from a full day of very close work, to accept Mr. Picton's invitation. The rest of us would be along, he said, in a minute, to which Marcus and Lucius nodded wearily and headed on into the house. As soon as they were safely out of earshot, Mr. Moore's face filled with urgency. "All right," he said, putting his magnifying lens down. "That's it for tonight. Everybody knock off."
"But why, John?" Miss Howard said. "There's still some daylight and not that much left to do."
"That's exactly the point," Mr. Moore answered. "We're going to need some part of this thing to be intact in the morning." I was still confused, but Cyrus had begun to nod in understanding. "It's not here, is it, Mr. Moore?"
"The odds are against it," Mr. Moore answered. "A 45 caliber bullet would have left a big enough mark that one of us would have seen it by now."
"So why save some of the thing?" I asked.
"Because I don't want Rupert to have to outright lie in court, or Marcus and Lucius to have to perjure themselves. There's only one place that bullet can be, and we're going to get it. Then, tomorrow morning, we'll put it in what's left of this thing and let them find it. None of us are going to be called to testify in this particular area, so we don't need to worry about lying. And so far as the rest of them will know, they'll be telling the truth."
The doctor's eyebrows arched a bit.
"John, you realize that you're suggesting—"
"Yes, I know what I'm suggesting, Kreitzler," Mr. Moore said, moving away from the table. "But there's no other option. We all know we'd never get a judge to order something like this without the mother's permission, not based on the little evidence we've gathered so far."
He paused, waiting for arguments, but none came.
"I'll check in the basement for a shovel," Mr. Moore went on. "We'll do the job tonight."
Miss Howard, Cyrus, and I looked at one another in a little shock. But the doctor summed up all our deeper feelings by saying,
"Moore's right. It's the only way we can be sure."
All five of our heads started nodding slowly, but much as we may have agreed that Mr. Moore's plan was the only way to both get what we needed and look out for Mr. Picton's and the detective sergeant's legal and ethical positions, that didn't change the fact that we were contemplating a grisly, frightening, and illegal action, one what had gotten many people hanged, or worse, over the centuries. It took, you might say, a little adjusting to. Mr. Moore did manage to find a shovel in the basement, along with a couple of lengths of strong rope, and he put them all outside the kitchen door while the rest of us were in the living room. Then we all went in to dinner, the prospect of what we were about to undertake keeping most of us pretty quiet through the better part of the meal. Mr. Picton, fortunately, filled up the silence with a stream of talk about the cases he'd been studying. Then it was back into the living room for a little more of the music what Cyrus had been playing the day before. Finally, the time came to head upstairs. We'd have to wait for Mr. Picton and the detective sergeants to go to bed, at which point the rest of us would leave the house separately to meet up around the corner on Boston Avenue. From there, we'd head down to the cemetery.
Chapter 34. The house finally grew completely quiet at just past 1 o'clock. I left my room carefully and got outside, almost running headlong into Mr. Moore on the front lawn as he made his way around from the kitchen with his shovel and rope. We didn't see any sign of the rest of our fellow ghouls until we arrived at the appointed meeting spot around the corner. The doctor and Miss Howard were sharing a cigarette, with Cyrus peering anxiously around at the darkened houses on either side of the street. He could have saved himself some sweat, the way I saw it, even given what we were up to. Boston Spa was obviously the kind of town what shut down early and stayed shut down even on a Saturday night.
"All right, now, remember," the doctor murmured as Mr. Moore and I reached them, "what we are about to undertake is a serious criminal offense. Moore and I will therefore be the only ones to actually participate. Stevie, you'll stand watch at this end of the street. Cyrus, you'll go an equal distance in the opposite direction.
Sarah will be our last line of defense. She'll guard the cemetery gate.
With the artillery, she said, producing the weapon what she used on really special occasions, a 45 caliber Colt revolver of her own, one with a short barrel and pearl grips. She checked its chamber with the quick moves of an expert as the doctor went on.
If you encounter anyone, any of you, you must claim complete ignorance. You're a guest of Mr. Picton's, and you're out taking the air on a lovely night. Understood?
Very well, then.
Mr. Moore started to move farther up the block with Miss Howard and Cyrus.
Why don't you stay here with Stevie until I've got the hole dug, Kreutzler? The fewer people inside at one time, the better, and it's not like...
Mr. Moore cut himself off quickly, though he'd already glanced at the doctor's bad left arm.
Yes, the doctor said, following Mr. Moore's eyes down to his slightly withered limb.
I take your point, Moore. I wouldn't be much use to you in the digging. Very well. Signal when you're ready.
Nodding and looking a bit sorry for what he'd said, even though he'd clearly meant no offense, Mr. Moore hustled off with the other two.
The doctor and I just stood there for a few minutes, myself not knowing exactly what to say to break the awkward moment brought on by the subject of his arm. But he soon made that job unnecessary by himself glancing down at the thing again, and then laughing once, quietly.
"It's strange," he whispered. "I never thought it might actually serve some purpose."
"Huh?" was all I could say.
"My arm," the doctor whispered back. "I've been so used to seeing it as a source of pain and a reminder of the past that I never imagined it could be anything else."
I knew what he was talking about with that reminder of the past business. When he was only 8, the doctor's left arm had been smashed by his own father during the worst of their many fights. The older man had then kicked his son clear down a flight of stairs, aggravating the injury and making sure that the arm would never heal properly. The recurring pain in the scarred bones and muscle, along with the underdeveloped state of the arm, served to keep the trials what the doctor had been through during his childhood pretty constantly in his mind. But as for what he meant by the arm serving some purpose, I couldn't tell, and I said so.
"I was referring to Clara Hatch," he said, taking his eyes off the arm and glancing up and down the street. "From our first meeting. I naturally felt some empathy with her, having lost the use of her right arm, quite probably because of an attack by her own mother."
We both turned when we started to hear the quiet sounds of a shovel digging into dirt. But it had been a wet summer, and as the shovel reached deeper, softer ground, the sound died away altogether. The doctor continued his story.
"Today I decided to use the coincidence of our injuries in my effort to make her feel safe enough in my presence to start to allow images of what happened to re-enter her thoughts."
"Images?" I asked. "You mean she doesn't remember the whole story?"
"A part of her mind does," the doctor answered. "But the greater portion of her mental activity is directed at avoiding and erasing such memories. You must understand, Stevie, that she is emotionally hobbled by the fact that her experience makes no apparent sense. How could her mother, who should have been the source of all safety and succor, possibly turn into a mortal threat? Then, too, she knows that Libby is still alive and could return to strike again. But the combination today of the set of colored pencils I gave her and the story I told her about my father and my injury seemed to at least plant the idea in her mind that she might begin to confront such confusions and fears and perhaps even share them with another person."
I smiled. "She really went for the pencils, huh?"
The doctor shrugged. "You've seen such things at the Institute. It's remarkable what seemingly mundane objects can achieve in such situations. A toy, a game, a colored pencil. Not surprisingly, the first one she reached for was red."
"Blood?" I asked quietly, figuring that in her position I probably would have made the same choice.
"Yes," the doctor answered, shaking his head and hissing. "Imagine the savagery of that scene, Stevie. It's no wonder she can't speak of it, that even its memory has been exiled to the farthest corners of her conscious mind. And yet from that corner it presses, it cries for release, and only if that release will be safe for her.
The doctor paused, thinking the matter over. A red stream. You remember the picture of the Weston's house that she showed Cyrus? There's a brook that runs behind it, and she added that brook to the picture today, but she drew it in red, gushing torrents of red. And beside the stream she drew a dead tree, a tree whose roots reached down into the red water. The doctor shook his head and held up his left hand, clenching it into a fist. I tell you, Stevie, if we do no more while we are here than help to mend that poor girl's mind, the trip shall not have been wasted. I thought about that for a few minutes, and then asked, how long do you figure it'll take before she can start to communicate with you about it? Actually, I'm fairly optimistic. Based on her behavior this afternoon, it should only be a matter of days before we can discuss the incident through pictures and simple questions. But as for getting her to speak, for that I will have to come up with some new strategies. We didn't say much more for a while. I guess I was just absorbing the idea of little Clara living out there on that farm, among people who'd once been strangers, trying desperately day and night not to think about why she should have to live with them, but at the same time wanting so badly to understand why. How could her brain operate when it was given two sets of orders that were so opposite and so urgent? How could she ever get a moment's sleep or even peace with all those voices screaming inside her skull, telling her to do different things? It was a miserable thought, and I began to be grateful, standing there on that street corner, that when I'd been a young boy in New York, I'd at least been clear about who my enemies were and what it would take for me to survive. Badly as she'd behaved, I didn't think my mother'd ever wanted me actually, literally dead. And for the first time I saw that as, if not a blessing, at least one of the better on a long list of bad choices. Suddenly there came the sound of approaching footsteps. The doctor and I withdrew into the shadow of an elm tree and waited, but it was only Miss Howard come to tell us that Mr. Moore was ready for the doctor. "Things are pretty quiet up there," she said, indicating the cemetery. So he had Cyrus give him a hand lifting the coffin out of the ground, not that it's all that heavy. The doctor gave her a grim nod, then turned to me. "All right, Stevie," he said. "You'll be on your own for a few minutes. Stay alert." The two of them moved back down Boston Avenue, and I stayed under the elm tree, staring at the shadows that were being thrown by the moon. A warm wind soon began to kick up, and that played hell with my vision and my imagination. All those shadows what surrounded me were turned into ghostly, man-shaped silhouettes, the whole collection of which was moving and dancing and, I became more and more convinced, getting ready to pounce on me. Oh, sure, I told myself it was the wind and that I didn't have anything to worry about. They were all tricks of the light in my eyes, just a lot of... Then I noticed something. One of those man-like silhouettes, a small one underneath a tree across the street, wasn't moving. Not only wasn't it moving, but it wasn't where it should have been, given the position of the moon. There were a couple of twinkling spots, too, right at about eye level. And for a shadow, it was doing something that was awfully close to smiling at me. I froze up tight, scared and bewildered. The more I stared at the thing, the more I grew convinced that it was an actual person. But at the same time, all that staring had started to make my vision go slightly crazy. I knew that I wasn't going to be able to figure anything out unless I could find a way to make the thing come out from under its tree and into the moonlight. But that might wind up being a very dangerous proposition. Whoever or whatever it was that I was watching, though, didn't seem to be sending up any alarm or making any hostile move. So I figured I'd be okay if I just took a few steps out from under my own tree and tried to get a better look. I started to walk. Then I shivered once, mightily, when the shadowy thing across the street mirrored the move. As soon as we were clear of all the shadows, I could see plainly who it was. El Niño, Señor Linares's little Filipino aborigine. He was dressed in those same clothes what were four sizes too big for him, and, for whatever reason, he was, in fact, smiling at me. Slowly lifting an arm, he seemed to try to signal to me in some way, and for a minute I grew less fearful. The attempt at communication and the smile
combined with his appealing round features to make him look something other than threatening. But then he made a different sort of move. Lifting his head, he reached up with one hand and ran a finger around his neck. Now, in most parts of the world what I know of, that only means one thing. But he was still smiling, so I gave him the benefit of the doubt for another few seconds on the off chance that I was reading him wrong. But what came next was in no way reassuring. Still grinning, he put his hand around his throat in a kind of chokehold, as if he meant to strangle someone. In this case, pretty apparently, yours truly. Shivering violently again, I turned and bolted up the street toward the cemetery, fully believing that the little man who I figured for some kind of assassin was going to follow me and that I was in a race for my life. I didn't look back. I'd seen how quick El Niño was, and I didn't want to slow down for even a second. When I hit the northern edge of the fenced-in cemetery, I got within sight of Miss Howard, who had her back to me. Not wanting to scream for help, I just picked up my pace, hoping that she'd catch the sound of my feet. She soon did, and when I was about 30 feet from her, and she could see the look on my face, she pulled out her revolver, holding and aiming it with practiced skill at the area behind me. Much relieved, I kept on running toward her, but then, when I saw her face go blank and her arms drop to her sides in confusion, I slowed down. She just looked at me and shrugged, and I stopped altogether, gasping for air and finally glancing behind me. The little Aborigine was nowhere to be seen. Miss Howard walked quickly over to join me as I leaned down, hands on my knees, to take in some big gulps of air and spit into the street. "Stevie," she said quietly, "what's happened?" "That servant of Señor Linares's," I answered. "El Niño, he was down there." In a flash, Miss Howard brought her pistol up again, though only as far as her hip this time. "What was he doing?" "Just watching me," I answered, finally getting my breathing under control. "And he made a sign with his hands. Miss Howard, I think he meant to kill me, but it was strange. He was smiling, too, the whole time." With her free hand, she grabbed my right arm and pulled me toward the cemetery gate. "Come on," she said. "The doctor will want to know about this." I've never counted myself a religious man, really. But when we got to the gate, I looked inside the graveyard and saw a scene what struck me as so unholy that I stopped dead in my tracks. The area directly ahead of us was lit partly by the moon, but also by the faint glow of a pair of arc street lamps what stood just outside the back fence of the cemetery. Together, these sources of light made it pretty impossible to mistake what was going on. The doctor was crouched over a small coffin, his jacket off and his shirt sleeves rolled up. The lid of the coffin lay to one side, along with a pile of dirt from a nearby open grave. In the doctor's gloved hands were a scalpel and a pair of steel forceps. He was working quickly but carefully, like a man carving a turkey at a table full of hungry people. Mr. Moore was standing to one side and looking away, a handkerchief over his mouth. It was pretty apparent that he'd been sick in the last few minutes. "Wait," was all I could say as Miss Howard started into the cemetery. It ain't worth interrupting him. We can tell him when he comes out." Miss Howard gave me the once-over in a way what said she completely understood my reluctance. "You stay here and keep watch," she said, "but I've got to tell him. The Aborigine may not have been alone. Do you want my revolver?" I looked down at the thing but just shook my head in reply. Like I've said, guns were never my style. Miss Howard walked quickly into Mr. Moore and the doctor, and though I couldn't hear what they said, I could see looks of extreme alarm register on both their faces. But we'd come too far to break the thing off now, even I knew that. So the two men just sent Miss Howard back to the gate, and then the doctor returned to his work with even more energy. I looked farther down Boston Avenue and saw Cyrus, who was peering back toward us, obviously wanting to know what the hell was going on. I thought to run up and tell him, but then I heard a satisfied sound, one what was maybe just a little too loud, given the situation, come from the doctor's direction. Turning, I saw him holding something up between his gloved fingers. It had to be the bullet. Mr. Moore looked at the thing and patted the doctor's back with a smile of relief. Then they quickly started to get the lid back onto the coffin. Looking over to me and Miss Howard, Mr. Moore hissed, "Stevie!" as loud as he felt it was safe to do. And, with the part of my stomach, what hadn't gone into my throat at the sight of El Niño, now starting to rise and join the rest,
I ran inside to them. The smell of dirt and decay hit me from about 10 yards away, though thankfully by the time I got to the gravesite, they'd refastened the lid of the little coffin. Then it was up to me and Mr. Moore, using the lengths of rope, to maneuver the thing back into the hole he'd dug, which we managed to do without too much trouble. This task kept me busy enough to avoid really taking in where I was, along with what I was doing, but once the coffin was down and we'd started to first refill the grave with dirt and then recover it with large sections of sod what Mr. Moore'd carefully cut away, I had a chance to glance around at all the headstones and monuments what was surrounding me. With a start, I suddenly realized that I was actually standing on little Thomas Hatch's grave. Moving quickly to do my job from another angle, I glanced at Thomas's and Matthew's headstones. The pair of them were identical, except for the words what were carved into each. In the upper portions, they displayed the boys' names and years of life, and under each name was the phrase, "Loving son of Daniel and Elspeth." But under these words were two different quotes. Thomas's read, "A lamb gone too soon to the lamb," while Matthew's said, "He that believeth in me shall not die." At the bottom of each stone, in lettering what was less stodgy and more flowing than the rest, was a message, "Love always from Mama." Maybe I was just looking for something to fix my mind on as a way of calming down, but it occurred to me to ask, how come they're buried here and not at the Hatch place? There's a cemetery out there behind the house. Many cities and towns now require burial in a designated public cemetery, the doctor answered, holding the small object he'd found up above his head and studying it. For reasons of public health. I'm sure Mrs. Hatch didn't object. She must have realized that the chances of anyone attempting just what we're doing now were far more remote in a public graveyard.
Yes, and she had good reason to think so, Mr. Moore said, getting the last of the sod into place and trying to cover the remaining visible cuts in the ground by pulling up clumps of loose grass and sprinkling them over the cuts. It's a lot easier to get caught in a place like this. He stood up, examined his work, and then nodded once in satisfaction. Okay, let's get the hell out of here.
The doctor moved quickly for the gate, but I lagged behind with Mr. Moore, who was struggling to get his jacket back on as he dragged the shovel and bits of rope. Taking these last items from him, I asked, "So you found it? The bullet, I mean?"
"Looks like it," he answered, not wanting to get too hopeful before he was sure he had reason. "In very good condition, too. But as for whether or not it's the bullet, only tomorrow will tell. I hear you had a little run-in with our Filipino friend." I shook my head and let out a sigh of relief. I thought I was dead for sure.
"I doubt he meant anything like that," Mr. Moore answered. "You've seen him work. If he wanted to kill you, it's a safe bet you never would have heard or seen a thing."
"Huh." I paused at the gate, realizing that Mr. Moore was right.
"But then," I said as Cyrus came running down to join us, "what did he want?"
"That we do not know," the doctor answered, having figured out who and what I was talking about. "Though we must try to find out. However, what's most vital right now, Stevie, is that you not mention the encounter to either the detective sergeants or Mr. Picton. As far as they're concerned, as far as we're all concerned," he glanced once more into the cemetery, and then we all started to walk away, "none of this ever happened."
"You won't get any argument out of me," Mr. Moore answered, taking a cigarette the doctor offered him. "I'm not too proud of this little escapade."
"Do you think Matthew Hatch will reach out from the grave, Moore?" the doctor needled. "To rebuke you for disturbing his eternal rest?"
"Maybe," Mr. Moore answered. "Something like that. You don't seem too damn troubled along those lines, Kreitzer, I must say."
"Perhaps I have a different understanding of what we've just done," the doctor answered, his voice growing more serious. "Perhaps I believe that Matthew Hatch's soul has not yet known peace, eternal or otherwise, and that we represent his only chance of attaining it."
Lighting first Mr. Moore's cigarette and then one of his own, the doctor took a drag and got more animated.
"What I don't understand," he said, his mind jumping from subject to subject as nimbly as usual, "is what the devil they want. The man sends us a warning at number 808, saves Cyrus's life on Bethune Street, and now here, in another part of the state,
He evidently attempts to deliver some sort of deadly message to Stevie. What can it mean?
Señor Linares, Miss Howard answered, following the doctor's wandering thoughts, evidently wants us to know that he's aware of our movements and our actions.
Mr. Moore nodded. It seems like as long as we're not associating with his wife or trying to find the girl, we're all right. But if we cross those lines...
Is that what the Aborigine's signals to Stevie meant? The doctor wondered. That we can do what we like to and about Libby Hatch, so long as we leave the Linares family out of it?
Maybe, Mr. Moore answered with a shrug.
Well, then why doesn't the man just tell us as much?
The doctor asked, his frustration growing.
Why all these cryptic messages sent through a mysterious go-between?
I was shaking my head. I don't think that's what he meant.